We're very fortunate in Maine to have connections to people that spend time in other parts of the country and come back and enjoy our beautiful state with us, and not only enjoy our beautiful state with us, but make it a better place to live. One of these people is Billy Shore, who is the founder and CEO of Share Our Strength, which is a national nonprofit which is ending childhood hunger in America. And I specifically say ending childhood hunger in America because I know your goal is to end childhood hunger by 2015.
That's correct. We actually started with a goal of ending and a real strategic plan to end childhood hunger by 2020. And then when candidate Obama back in 2008 was running, he embraced our plan. And in the chaos of the campaign, something got transposed and it turned into 2015. And we weren't going to quarrel with him because it was the first time a president-elect had embraced what we were doing. So we got stuck with 2015, but we're actually going to be very close. We may need a little bit more time, but if so, I think we'll be able to make the case that we've earned it.
Well, yeah, that's 5 years shorter.
That's right. It's a big difference.
Yeah. And you only started doing this in 1984.
We started Share Strength in 1984, and we didn't start the No Kid Hungry campaign until about 2007. So for many, many years, we were a grant maker to other organizations, which we still are. But then about 6-7 years ago now, we developed this very specific campaign of our own and this very kind of concrete, you know, stake in the ground that said we're going to do this by a certain time.
This is one of the things that I was interested in when I was reading the article, and of course reading more about you because you've written 4 books, so you put plenty out there for people who are interested to find out more. And that is that you went from largely thinking about hunger relief as food banks and smaller efforts, and then you realized you had to do something more systemic. I'm reading this article by Jed Coffin, which is in the June 2013 issue of Maine Magazine. And you called it a naive notion that raising money and sending it to food banks could somehow end childhood hunger. You then realized that your approach wasn't systemic and didn't address the symptoms of the deeper issue. How did you come to that place?
Well, I think when we started the organization back in 1984, we did have, not as deep an understanding of the issue of hunger as we do now. We've come to understand that hunger is really a symptom of a deeper and more complex problem, which is poverty. Poverty is hard to solve and poverty is complex, but feeding a child is not. So we tried to strike this balance between even if you can't end poverty, can you address hunger and can you address it effectively and actually end it, at least in certain segments of the population? And as we thought about what we wanted to accomplish, we really took to heart the words of a writer named Jonathan Kozol, who said you should pick battles that are big enough to matter but small enough to win, which I really liked because there's kind of these large campaigns that we would all love to wage and different ways we'd like to change the world. But when it comes to big enough to matter, small enough to win, in our world, we asked ourselves, what was that? And we realized that when it came to children in this country, in America, who were hungry on a chronic basis, that was actually a winnable battle. And so we got very refocused around not just making grants to other organizations, which we continue to do, but to see if we could use our vantage point, our experience, to some degree exert some leadership to see if we could get people to pull in the same direction. And ultimately, that's what we've tried to do around childhood hunger and the effort to end it.
What you call a triggering event in one of your books was, I believe, the famine in Ethiopia in 1984. And I believe some would argue that that is an event that was really not easy to win.
Yeah, for sure. And Ethiopia continues to struggle with famine and hunger. But in 1984, just the kind of the serendipitous nature of when things happen. I had worked in government for about 8 or 9 years at that point for Senator Gary Hart from Colorado. He'd run for president and just come in second in the Democratic nomination contest to Walter Mondale. This would have been in, August of 1984. And so I'd had this very intense period of working with him, traveling to, all 50 states, sometimes 4 states a day. And then decompressing after that, was literally stuck in a traffic jam on Interstate 270 outside of Washington, D.C., and probably doing something I shouldn't have been doing, which was reading the Washington Post while I was stuck in traffic. But there was this story about 200,000 to die this summer in Ethiopia, and it just seemed, for me, it was this jarring juxtaposition between all the issues you talk about in a campaign, from the kind of the antiseptic venue of a stage and then in the bubble of, the limousine and the Secret Service motorcade and so forth, and then thinking, boy, there are real life and death, you know, issues at stake in the decisions we make, as I learned more about the Ethiopian famine. And so for me, that was the catalyst. And our focus initially at Share Our Strength was international. We quickly realized that there were significant issues here in the United States as well, and that a lot of our stakeholders and supporters would want us to focus on those, and that we could actually probably realistically make more progress dealing with hunger here in the United States. We continue to make grants to a few places overseas, but most of our focus is here in the U.S. now.
Hunger relief, and specifically ending childhood hunger, is something to you that's deeply personal. And it's something that also seems to have some linkage back to a sense of faith. In one of your books, you actually write about, I think it was something about the Jewish faith and sort of the points of light idea. Mm-hmm. So is this something that was hard for you to reconcile, working in politics over here and then working and thinking over here about the bigger picture?
Well, a little bit. I learned a tremendous amount doing the political work that I did, and got to work on a whole variety of issues, and thought it was, you know, would have never done it any other way. But at the same time, it did feel removed from a lot of the way people really live their lives. Probably, you know, the most personal part of it for me was I had my father was a district administrative assistant to a congressman from Pittsburgh, and my father was this very unpretentious guy, very casual all the time, never wore a watch, never carried a pen, was not a very meticulous person. But this was a time back in the 60s and 70s when Congress wasn't televised, members of Congress didn't come home that much. So for all intents and purposes, for most people, my father was the congressman from Pittsburgh. And if we walked two blocks down the street to get a pizza, which we would do typically on a Friday evening, it would take us about 2 hours. So many people would come out of their houses and say, Mr. Shore, my aunt lost her Social Security check, or my uncle needs to get into the Veterans Hospital. Can you help him? And that was just what my dad did. He did it 24 hours a day in the most relaxed way and kept track of it all somehow. And I just grew up thinking, this is what you're supposed to do with your life. You're supposed to help the people in your community. He never preached about it. He wasn't a preachy kind of guy. And I don't remember him ever saying, you know, this is what's expected of you. He just kind of modeled the behavior. So in that sense, it was very personal, as you say.
And is that somehow part of the reason why you ended up going to Washington initially and being part of the social revolution that was happening at the time?
I think so. I was fascinated by Congress. I was fascinated by using public policy to create change in some ways that I'm really, I think, only just beginning to, you know, recognize and understand and start to reflect on. Share Our Strength has kind of come full circle that way, because we started purely doing private sector work and funding emergency food assistance programs and community efforts, but have more recently come to realize that there is a way that organizations like ours can intersect with public institutions, with state governments, with the federal government. There are programs like school breakfast and summer feeding and the food stamp, SNAP, what we now call SNAP program, that private organizations like ours can have a big impact in shaping and making more effective. So I think there's if you think of kind of a three-legged stool with government, the private sector, and the business community all working together, you can get some pretty big things done that way.
You talked about in one of your books your son, Zach, getting on the bus himself. And actually, I believe he was striking a pose with two other young men. Tell the story about this.
So, well, this was, I think, on Zach's field. I think it was on his field trip to New York, I think you're referring to, when he was an eighth grader. And I remember it, just being this very kind of poignant moment for me as understanding that, one of my sons was kind of growing up and was kind of on his own. I remember the kids getting on the bus and all the parents being, very anxious and waving to them and trying to get their attention. And the minute they stepped on the bus, none of them were looking out the window. They were paying no attention to us. They'd really kind of grown up. And then I think there was also a time I wrote about after 9/11, where he'd gone down to the mall in a show of just, kind of support for the nation on the National Mall by the Washington Monument, which a lot of people did. And again, I started to realize at that moment, though, like my father, I had not been particularly preachy to Zach and had not said, you know, kind of this is what's expected of you. Some of that kind of social change work and that notion of being engaged in your community had kind of seeped through, and he'd started to make his own decisions. But I was, you know, as a dad, excited and proud to see that he was getting engaged in that way.
I'm sure it was exciting for you because you also talk a lot about some of the misadventures of Zach and
yes.
Molly, especially in one of these books, which is interesting for me because I have children of this age, and I definitely have been involved in overseeing some of their misadventures. But that interesting contrast between going out into the world and doing something larger and also kind of retreating into your own individual world and doing something equally important, but somehow on a smaller scale with your own children, perhaps even having less control over them.
Yes.
Well, what was that like for you?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, look, the toughest job any of us have, I think, is parenting. There's no question about it. I've got three kids now. Zach's now 28 and Molly's 24, and I've got an 8-year-old son, Nate. You know, with Zach in particular, I was probably, traveling in a way more than I should have been. I think I was a very good father, and I think he thinks I was a very good father, but I think I also missed a lot of things that, as you get older and wiser, you would not do again. You wouldn't, make those kind of sacrifices again. And so Zach had a little bit of a rocky path to where he is today. He's incredibly successful, actually works for a radio station, the all-news station in Washington, D.C., WTOP, and as a father himself, married and with a baby. I think kids have to, find their way, and I think you have to, again, model it to the degree that you can. But at the end, they find their way, and they're all on their own timetable. You know, there's such pressure, I think, today among so many young people to feel like the, kind of the parade is marching by and they better get in it in just the right place or they're going to have failed. And I think in particular, so many young people think that a successful life is an unbroken string of successes, when usually it's just the opposite. Usually it's your failures that you learn from, and it's your mistakes and the bad luck and the misfortunes, some of which are just unavoidable in life, and sometimes are, married to bad judgments. But those are the things that, if you talk to a lot of successful people about how they became successful, it wasn't because they never had a misstep. It was just the opposite.
Your son Nathan is 8.
Yes.
And obviously there's a little bit of an age difference between your oldest and your youngest child. What did you learn over the course of those years that you came back and are now using to parent your younger child a little bit differently?
Yeah. Well, I think of it a little bit like, taking the SAT test, because even if you take it 3 or 4 times, your scores really don't change very much. So I'm not sure I'm that much wiser. But I do know that I remember when Nate was born and I was walking with him through a grocery store and, doing some shopping late at night and had him on my shoulder, and an older father walked by and said to me, you have no idea how quickly it goes. And I said, actually, I do because of my older kids. I think, again, just, I think being present, not just to your kids, but to all the people in your life that are meaningful to you is probably the most important thing that any of us can do. And I think that when I think about our work at Share Our Strength, it's really about the very idea of sharing strength is about being present to what people around you need and to what you have to give. My wife is actually way, way smarter about this than I am. I learned this from her. We got married 10 years ago, and she'd been coming to Maine her whole life, which is how I got introduced to Maine. And she just has this real sense of, being present to others is the most important thing you can do. And if she ever sees me, while I'm in a conversation, look at my iPhone or something like that, man, I get a kick under the table like you wouldn't believe.
It's funny you would say that because I've actually met your wife, and I've commented to the significant man in my life, Kevin Thomas. He and I have been to events with you and your wife, and she's very present, and she seems to very much enjoy the events. Yeah, there are a lot of people who you go to an event for a nonprofit, and it's sort of like a check it off your list, or maybe it's a more social thing, but she's very present, she's very engaged. And even your sister, we had the same feeling about your sister. I mean, this was something that it's a family thing, and that you all care very much about that.
Yeah.
How do you keep that energy up? Because You were telling me that there are 40 Taste of the Nation events that are across the country raising money for Share Our Strength, and there are countless other events and things that have to do with fundraising. How do you keep up that energy?
Well, I think, you know, family, I think, is a really important part of it. And so instead of it making it kind of an either-or thing or something that would seem, you know, spending time with family would be at odds with your work, we've really made it kind of a, you know, a family adventure. My sister, Debbie, really co-founded Share Our Strength with me. When I had the idea, she was the first person I spoke with, and we've been doing it. We've been literally sitting next to each other for 28 years. And then Rosemary, who had a career in business before we met, got very excited about what we were doing, and so we've just, you know, made it so that our family is always included. Even our son Nate comes to a lot of things, so it doesn't feel like a trade-off. I also think that, you know, for some reason we had a, when you ask about, you know, how do you kind of keep the energy for this, for some reason when we started, we did have this sense of this is going to take a long time. You know, I'd written this book about called The Cathedral Within, about using cathedral building as a metaphor for how you work on something your whole life and maybe don't see that work finished. And for some reason, Debbie and I in particular had this sense that this is going to take 25 or 30 or 40 years. And so I don't know if we paced ourselves, but we believed that, you know, if we didn't have the big wins that we wanted in the first year or two, if we didn't have everything go right, that was okay because we just had a longer view of it. And I think that's helped sustain our energy as well.
Well, this was actually a quote that I had bookmarked in your first book, Revolution of the Heart, which was from 1995, and it's from Reinhold Niebuhr. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final favor of love, which is forgiveness. And this is in your very first book in 1995.
Yes.
So
yes,
you are setting the stage for what is going to come.
Yeah. Yeah. For some reason, we just had that. We did have this instinct that this would take a long time, that time would be on our side, and that, you know, that it would, again, that's kind of the paradox in most social change work, is the things you want to accomplish take a significant amount of time to do. Almost all the incentives run in the other direction. People want to know what you've accomplished in the short term, or they want to know what your overhead is, or they want to know, you know, these kind of like smaller, more immediate things. And, you know, you have a responsibility back to your stakeholders to make sure you give them that information. But you also, I think, have to find ways to build a bridge for people so that they see this is going to take longer, and help bridge their experience so that they still want to be part of this in the long term.
You do talk about that in one of the books that you wrote. You talk about the importance of coming into something in your 20s and the enthusiasm of youth and really harnessing that, but then continuing to gain wisdom over time and not burning out. Do you feel like you came into this with the enthusiasm of youth and have somehow gained wisdom and been able to kind of keep showing up every day?
I hope so. You know, part of it for Share Our Strength is we've been very, we really believe that, you know, our core values don't change, but everything else is up for grabs. Everything else is on the table. And so we've innovated a lot. We've, you know, for me in particular, I've never had, over the course of 28 years, I've never had a year at Share Our Strength that felt like the year before. It's always felt like in a completely new job. And so we've, you know, as I say, we've reinvented, we've expanded, we've brought new constituencies into the work. Just as we started out funding emergency food assistance efforts and then grew to running our own campaign to end childhood hunger, we started out working in the private sector. Now we're working with, you know, governors and members of Congress on a daily basis. It's changed a tremendous amount, and I think that change is what really keeps you fresh. And again, your core doesn't change, your values don't change, but the way you do it, I think, should always be, you know, reexamined.
There is this sense of always going from the internal to the external to the internal to the external. When I'm looking at two of your books, The Cathedral Within and The Light of Conscience, I mean, there is this sense that there has to be something in you that you return to in order to know that you're heading in the right direction, that you're building this cathedral. This book, The Cathedral Within, I think that it was called initially, you proposed it as something else.
Yes. I'm trying to remember what I even thought about calling it. I think it was something about cathedral building, but I remember, what I do remember is meeting with this really wonderful editor at Random House named Ann Godoff, who's now an editor somewhere else, but as she was hearing my kind of pitch, you know, my 30 seconds, what this book was going to be about, because it wasn't written yet, she said to me, well, she said, if it's the cathedral within that you're writing about, then that's a book that I want to publish. And it really, really affected my thinking, because I realized that, you know, she was helping me kind of, again, make this bridge between the book that I wanted to write and the book that she thought people would want to read, and how you make it more interdirected. And, you know, at the end of the day, for Share Our Strength, that's certainly, when you look at who our most effective supporters and stakeholders are, they're all people who have been affected and impacted internally, have changed in some way. I always think it's interesting when people say they've been moved by something, because when you say you've been moved, that means you started one place and you ended somewhere else. And that's what all social transformation is really about. So we try to create experiences where people have that sense of being moved, where they have that sense of being transformed even. I call it bearing witness, going to places and letting yourself see and feel and sharing what you felt in ways that you know, that can almost kind of sneak up on you that you weren't expecting.
Is it also possible that what you're doing is connecting them with something inside themselves that already existed, so that they aren't really changed so much as just connecting with that still small voice that people talk about?
Well, I think that's a great point. That's a great way to put it. You know, the fundamental conviction that runs through the whole idea of Share Our Strength is that people, that everybody does have a strength to share, that everybody does have something within them that they want to give, that people are looking for meaning. This is not an original idea on our part. We all know this. People are searching for meaning all across our society. And so to create vehicles in which they can access that, and I guess access that part of themselves, to your point, I think has been, you know, whether we were always doing that at the conscious level or not, I think that's really what the work has been about.
We've had multiple people on our show who are working toward the ending of childhood hunger. We actually had John Woods on very early, who's the main Share Our Strength. We've had most recently Kristen Miele from Good Shepherd Food Bank here in Maine. But early on, we had Mark Swan from the Purple Street Research Center here in Portland. And a lot of listeners have known him for the last 20 years doing this good work that he does with homelessness and feeding the hungry and teenagers and the new teen shelter that they have. And he was on the Share Our Strength bus just the other day going at a Taste of the Nation. And he said to me, you know, I read Billy Shore's book. It changed me. It's something that I kind of held on to. And I can't tell you how many copies I have given out to other people. So it is actually important that you've documented in some way your own journey, starting in your book, 1995 to now, because it gives other people hope.
Well, I hope that's the case. I always think of the words of the writer and the director, Elia Kazan, who is a movie director, and he once wrote that the more personal something is, the more universal that it is. And so, you know, usually I find my first instinct when I'd start to write a story about my children or something like that is I would think, like, why in the world would anybody care about this? But, you know, those types of personal stories really do have, they strike a universal chord, and people get them.
Is there also the possibility, when you put yourself out there this much, when you make it so personal, that you could be more easily hurt when things don't go your way, or when people don't see what you're trying to put across, or maybe misinterpret?
That's a really good question. I don't know. Again, I think vulnerability is a kind of an effective place to lead from for those same reasons. And so I think making yourself vulnerable, because we all are, is really saying that is making yourself authentic. And I think authenticity is the key to leadership. So when people lead from this, you know, kind of, I don't know what, you know, whether it's a man or a woman, this kind of macho sense of, you know, having all the answers and having done everything right, I think that doesn't ring true to people. I think that's not authentic. So I think the idea of being a little bit vulnerable and being a little bit personal, it's a little bit of a risk, but I don't think it's a big one, because I think, again, all, you know, people know that all, basically all of us are like that.
You spend a lot of time traveling to different places, and you've talked about this in the books that you've written, and working with the leader of a children's choir or a group that was employs people who are released from prison, and meeting with other people who are involved in social change. What are some of the common denominators that you've noticed amongst the people, other people who are really doing something in the world of social justice?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. I think often people are, leading from a place that relates to where their own need is. And I think that's one common denominator. I think, to do this work, usually the odds are so formidable when you're trying to change something, whether it's hunger, the environment, climate change, poverty, that you have to have a little bit of a sense of being willing to break the rules as well. If you just do things in the conventional way, you're probably going to get conventional results. When people ask, what we hire for at Share Our Strength, my first response always is jaywalkers. I don't want people who are just going to stand and wait at the light. I don't want felons either, but we want people who are going to, really do what they have to do to get the job done. And I think you see that certainly in a lot of the entrepreneurs that we've worked with. And I guess, finally, and it relates to this idea of bearing witness, people who really put themselves close to the issue. One of the reasons I think we've stayed fresh at Share Our Strength is we go up, we kind of force ourselves to get away from our desk and get out into the community and see and feel things that we know are going to move us. My wife Rosemary always talks about how, if you go to Ethiopia once and then you talk about it the following year and the next year and the next year and you never go back, it becomes what she calls like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. It starts to fade, it gets a little bit pale. And so you've got to reconnect to that.
As you were talking, it kind of is interesting. I'm looking at the title of your latest book, "The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men." That's what you're describing. This is the quest and malaria. You're
yes.
describing people who have just said, we're not going to go with the status quo. We're going to believe that something like ending malaria, ending childhood hunger is possible.
Yeah, you've got to be a little bit unreasonable, I think, because when people hear it on face value, they say things like, that's not going to happen. That's too big of a goal. And so it does take people who push, I think, maybe unreasonable in terms of their goals, even unreasonable in terms of their tactics or strategies sometime, but still somehow stay within, at least enough within the mainstream that they can build the support they need and the constituency they need to get that done. That book takes its title from a George Bernard Shaw passage in a play, Man and Superman, in which he says the reasonable man adapts himself to the world around him. The unreasonable man tries to get the world to adapt itself to him. Therefore, all progress in changing the world depends on the unreasonable man. So I got stuck with that gender bias, which was George Bernard Shaw's, not mine, but I've heard about it from a few places.
Well, you talk about the social entrepreneur, the moral entrepreneur. You talk about the idea of entrepreneurial approaches. Do you think that the entrepreneurs that you're talking with and to, do you think that these are essentially what one would say are unreasonable men?
I think a lot of them are. If you go back and if you think about people, take somebody like Wendy Kopp, who started Teach for America. The idea when she started that you could take people and train them fairly lightly and insert them into the toughest schools in the country where they have the greatest problems. And if you would have said to anybody in 10 years from now, do you think that will be the number one source of employment from the top colleges in the country? That's where the highest degree of top college students now go to Teach for America. They'd say that's crazy. There's no way that's possible. Teachers' unions and everything else. Or if you take Alan Casey and Michael Brown, who started City Year program, a national service program, and said you're going to have this core, and not only in all the major cities in the U.S., but in South Africa and London and Ireland, people would have said no. So there's definitely that element of people, and we've certainly seen them in our organization. Sometimes the people who are the most effective advocates for Share Our Strength, thank goodness they're on our side, because they could be very difficult if they weren't. They're that strong-willed about it.
Well, that is an interesting point, that the unreasonable people are not easy often.
No, they're not. And at the heart of this book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, I wrote about a doctor named Steve Hoffman, who's waging this kind of David and Goliath struggle against some of the big pharmaceuticals to develop what he thinks is a more effective vaccine to end malaria, which kills a huge number of children in Africa every year. And Steve is, he has his loyal fans and his loyal friends, but he's also got a lot of critics. He's, you know, he's broken a lot of glass to get where he is, and that's just, that's part of the territory.
Your grandfather, might he have been an unreasonable man?
He might have been. I didn't know him very well, but I found this great picture of him. He was in Russia in 19 would have been the early part of the 1900s. Was a member of the Tsar's army, but was also part of a group of kind of saboteurs who were putting out an underground newspaper against the Tsar. He eventually fled to the United States and ended up at Ellis Island in New York in 1911. I think he died when I was just probably 2 or 3 years old, so I didn't know him well. But I'd heard stories about him, and then have this one photograph, which is very precious to me, of them conspiring to put together this underground newspaper.
So it's kind of fascinating that there is even this genetic component to this unreasonableness that can run throughout families.
There could be. I've never thought of it that way. I'll have to keep a close eye on Nate now to see whether he's showing any signs of that strain.
What do you like to do when you're not fighting childhood hunger?
Well, I love to be in Maine. Goose Rocks is really precious to us, and we spend a lot of time there. We keep the little cottage open all year round and get there for 4-day weekends. So spending, Nate and Rosemary and I love to travel. We love to be with our family. We spend a lot of time with my older son as well, and Rosemary's family. And, you know, I also read a lot. I love to write. I really do. I'm a slow writer. My books come out about once every 5 years, which is not the way to really kind of sustain an audience of readers or make a living. But I really enjoy it. So I think that, travel, walking the beach, you know, all the things that everybody else in Maine loves to do, I think we love to do too.
What are some of the best places you've ever visited?
Well, we've got this very special relationship with Monhegan Island. We take a little vacation from our vacation every summer and go over there for, we went over the first time 5 years ago for a night and stayed at the Island Inn. And then the next year we went for 2 nights, and then the next year for 3 nights. This year we'll be there for 5 nights. I think just the, you know, the quiet and the being together and the hiking and so forth. But we've traveled a lot as a family. We just came back from, one of the things we realized is we love Maine so much that we're never going to see the rest of the country unless we force ourselves to. So the day Nate got out of school, which I think was June 6th, we flew to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and visited, you know, the national parks, the Grand Tetons and Yellowstone. And I've been to all 50 states many, many times, but I had not been to the Western National Parks, and Rosemary and Nate hadn't either. So that was really extraordinary, and I think we're hooked on that now. So maybe we can spare 5 days away from Maine every other summer or so.
Well, it really is amazing to think about what you have accomplished in the short period of time you've been doing, the relatively short period of time you've been doing this since 1984. I know you only have till 2015 to end childhood hunger, but it strikes me that if anybody's going to be able to do it, you and your group are.
Well, thanks. We're getting pretty close, and in some states where we've made a disproportionate investment just to kind of prove the concept, to say if we throw everything we have at it, you know, is our strategy sound enough that if resources are not an object, we can succeed. So there's some states like Maryland, Colorado, Arkansas, where in addition to all the other places we're working, we've put in, you know, more than usual, and we've seen amazing results. And, you know, in Maryland, for example, 42% of, when we started, 42% of the eligible kids were getting school breakfast, and by the end of this year, it'll be 63%. So we'll have gone from a minority to a majority, and all of the kids by 2015 will be getting it. And that's true in Arkansas and Colorado as well. Whether we'll be able to, you know, move that into all 50 states by 2015, we'll be pretty close. But as I say, if we need a little bit more time, I think most people will say we've earned it with those successes.
At the end of the article that Jed Coffin wrote in Maine Magazine about you, he asked you, what is the universe trying to tell you? And your answer was that all of us, no matter what we do or where we are, can and want to contribute. All of us have the capacity to share our strength in our own best way. So people who are listening who want to be part of this effort, how do you suggest that they connect back in some way to that still small voice that we were referring to and somehow help you?
Yeah. Well, I think listening to that voice, and doesn't necessarily have to be by helping us, although we would, you know, love to have people's help. But I think, you know, finding what it is that you care most about, what it is you're most passionate about, not just in terms of external issues, what's going on in the world, but things that you most enjoy doing. We work, as you know, with a lot of chefs and restaurateurs, and we do food and wine events here in Maine and around the country. And the most common response I get back from chefs is, I never knew I could make a difference in this community just by being a chef. You know, they think of this as their work and as their vocation and their trade. But then when we've created this vehicle to say, and also by cooking or also by teaching nutrition education and things you might take for granted, you can actually impact other people's lives. That's kind of an epiphany for them. And so our intellectual challenge, our design challenge is, how do we do that with other communities? How do we do it with architects and writers? We've at Share Strength, we've had more than 15 books published by Random House and other publishers, where writers donated original work to us. I actually, this is kind of a main connection, but back in 1987, when Gary Hart's presidential campaign came to a very sudden end, I was trying to figure out, okay, how does Share Our Strength go next? And I got two checks in the mail on the same day, one from Stephen King, and one from a writer named Sidney Sheldon, who's no longer alive. But it was one of those moments where I was asking myself, what's the universe trying to tell me, right? Where these two checks came from, these two writers. And I realized that we need to find ways to get others involved in what we do. So I would hope that people would, you know, a good place to start would be our website at shareourstrengthnokidhungry.org, and just go to that website, and we've got a whole list of, we've got a specific, you know, kind of section on how to get involved. And we've got people who participate in what we call the Great American Bake Sale, or the Bake Sale for No Kid Hungry. We have thousands and thousands of school-aged children across the country and others who do bake sales and contribute money to us. We have people who participate in our events. We have people who are involved in contacting their schools to see if their schools offer the school breakfast program, and they're helping us do a crowdsourced school breakfast map. So there's so many ways for people to get involved. But again, I think what you call that still small voice within is really the key to it.
I appreciate your sharing your voice, not even the still small voice, but the larger, louder voice. And it's really a privilege to be sitting with you, Bill Shore, the founder and CEO of Share Our Strength. And I really wish you all the best in your quest to end childhood hunger. I know that you will.
Thanks. Well, have me back on after 2015, and we'll see where we are.